On October 21st, 2015, Stolen Dress Entertainment, in conjunction with Team Fox, brings you the Million McFly March. Fans of the Back to the Future franchise will gather, dressed as Marty McFly, to participate in the largest gathering of Marty McFlys in history and celebrate the Back to the Future films while also raising money for Parkinson's research through Team Fox. More details about the event, as well as links to donate and RSVP for the event, can be found at millionmcflymarch.com. I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 1972. The album is Class Clown. The artist, of course, is George Carlin, and my guest is Paul Gilmartin. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, as we discussed, we've done the album a few times.
Mm-hmm. How can you not?
Right? Well, that's exactly right. And I was just... What I was saying on the way up here is that, you know, I have some new notes, but now I feel like I should just... put it on you to just do all the work, if that's cool. No, but it's one of those things where I only got a chance to re-listen to a couple tracks, and I was happy to discover I found some new things about it.
Like what?
Well, just that the changeover from cutesy cutesy kid like mm-hmm. stuff to I'm about to get serious happens with a dog crap song at the end of side one, and side two eventually he eventually goes full bore into, like, it's still sweet, like, yeah. But he gets into Nam and stuff. None of that stuff is on the first side. And it is, like, this transitional...
In the seven words.
Yeah, 100%. You know, the greatest thing pretty much ever committed to celluloid. I just said celluloid, but you know what I meant. Vinyl, the name of this podcast, Comedy on
Petroleum.
Vinyl. Yeah, petroleum. Thank you. There we go. They're both, you know...
Is celluloid made from petroleum? Seems like it should be.
I think so, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah. So thank you. Thank you for justifying my mistake. I appreciate it. So when did you first hear the album, number one?
I remember it so distinctly. I was about 7 or 8 years old. And let's see, I was born in 63. Mm-hmm. So I would have been, I would have been older. So I would have been nine or 10.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody's older brother had a copy of it. And I remember I was at their house. And their mom went out to grocery shop or something, and they went and ran and grabbed this album and put it on. And they're like, "You gotta hear this!" And I was absolutely just mesmerized. I'd never heard anybody question authority like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never heard anybody swear like that. But there was a point to everything, and there was an intelligence underneath it. That was, it's like, it was like all the feelings that you had as a kid
mm-hmm.
coming out of an adult mouth.
Right, right.
Because, you know, even at that age, you knew adults were fucking stupid in a lot of ways. Well, at least certain adults were fucking stupid. And you couldn't understand why they had lost. What happens between when you're a kid and you're a pain in the ass adult? And you just kind of, it's like George Carlin was the link. Between
100%.
Kids and boring adults that get off on being authoritarians.
Yeah.
And it gave me hope to, not that I was hopeless, but it allowed me to, when I went to Catholic grade school, you know, the next week or whatever, I think I probably looked at everything differently.
Yeah.
That I didn't have to take all this as... the gospel truth, not to use a pun.
Sure.
But it just, it was almost like the first time you did acid, where you just saw the world differently after that. You realized that your version of reality had maybe been smaller than reality might be.
Right. Isn't it lucky, though, to have that, like, I had that moment later than I wish I had it at 10, but to have that moment where this person's not just saying these things, it's with perfect clarity, but he's the first guy who's, like you said, I hadn't heard anybody swear that way. He's the first guy to swear intelligently, and to hear that first, mm-hmm. rather than to hear, like, I can't think of somebody to compare him to at the time, but say Andrew Dice Clay had been around at the time, not that he's a horrible comic, but... I would say his finesse with the swear words is less.
And I would say, you know, the biggest difference between an Andrew Dice Clay and a George Carlin is Andrew Dice Clay picks on people who are already lower 100%. On the chain of power in society, whereas George Carlin picks on the people who are on the top tier of society.
Yeah.
You know, he champions the underdog, and I think Andrew Dice Clay picks on the underdog. And George Carlin kept that attitude throughout his entire life.
Yeah.
He just always championed the underdog. He spoke truth to power. And, I mean, he tells a story about just idolizing Lenny Bruce. Mm-hmm. And Lenny was getting arrested at some gig for swearing. And George was like, I want to show my solidarity, so I'm going to go to jail with him.
Yeah.
And they're in jail together. And Lenny's like, what are you doing here? And George said, well, you know, I decided if you're going to jail, I'm going to jail too. And Lenny Bruce called him a schmuck.
That's so perfect. I mean, it's... I know the feeling that George Carlin must have had to when you try and do something, to impress an idol. But you think you're doing it for the right reasons too. You think you're so justified and just be like, and Lenny Bruce is a perfect person to shut you the fuck up about your self-righteousness. But I feel like he could only, his activism had to be in this form, at least at this time. It had to be this, like, not hippie isn't really perfect because he's not 100% a hippie. He loves peace, of course, but he's got this, the fuck authority thing is his way of doing it is very different than a protest.
And there was a lot of part of hippiedom that was full of shit.
For sure.
And I think he saw through a lot of that, if not immediately, certainly eventually.
Yeah. And it's not, there's nothing tinged, I mean, he'd made a career out of making fun of stoners, out of making fun of stoner hippies. I mean, with, you know, just with one weatherman character, but that was enough to make it clear that, you know, he was a big fan of thinking straight and, you know, while being anti-authority at the same time. Yeah. Do you have a favorite track? Is it easy enough to...
I think seven words.
Yeah.
Shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits. Tits shouldn't even be on the list. I haven't heard the album in probably 30 years.
Yeah.
And maybe not that long, maybe 20 years.
Yeah.
But I still remember so much of it. And another one that I... Cheese tits.
tater tits. Pizza
tater tits.
Onion tits.
Yeah. The other one that really stuck with me, especially because I was in Catholic school, was, is it possible that God can make a rock so big that he himself can't move it? And there's some joke about the international dateline. And I just loved how anti-authoritarian, how clever he was with his anti-authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about his influence on you. First of all, was this a thing that led you... I mean, was this one of the early things that got you interested in comedy, or were you already interested in it?
I think I was always interested in making people laugh because I had to.
Yeah.
In my family, things were... There was just always an underlying tension.
Yeah.
And so that would kind of... That was my way of taking the temperature of the room and saying, is everything okay here?
Mm-hmm.
And to get attention. But he was the first person that... that to me was an example of how a comedic mind worked.
Okay.
And I don't think I ever mimicked his delivery or necessarily his writing style, but what I absolutely took from him was trying to take down hypocrites who were in power.
Yeah.
And, you know, I also had a silly part to my act, too, and a dark part to my act. And as I shared with you as we were coming up the stairs, I got to meet him once. I was working at a horrible gig in Las Vegas. It was at Bally's, and they used to have Catch a Rising Star? I think it was Catch a Rising Star. And they had the room was nice enough, and the people were nice, but it was... a lot of blue hairs. And the way the room was set up was there was a lot of couches. And in a comedy club, you want people at small tables as close to the front of the stage as possible. And this was, it was like if you were at home plate, they were at first, second, and third base.
Jesus.
in big velvet couches. And Buddy Hackett's kid, Sandy Hackett, was the headliner. I was the feature act. And and my wife and George was playing the big celebrity room at Bally's. And my wife kept saying, I've heard he's really nice to young comics. You should contact him. And I was like, you are fucking high. I am not contacting George Carlin. He is, you know, he is in another stratosphere. I don't want to bother him. And after like the second or third time she said it, I was like, all right, just to shut her up, I'm going to try to call him. So I called the front desk. They said, well, you can leave a message. And so I left a message. This is Paul. I'm a comic working at the thing. Didn't hear anything from him, which I didn't expect to hear. And then like 2 days later, hey, Paul, it's George. Why don't you come down to the show tonight if you can? Come on backstage. I'd love to meet you.
Holy
he has no idea who I am.
100%, yeah.
Yeah. Sat and talked with me for like 15 minutes. Was the nicest guy. So humble. It was just, he was everything I wanted him to be. And then he said, well, you know, I'm friends with Sandy. Maybe I'll come watch your set Sunday night, because he didn't have a show on Sunday night, I think. I can't remember. But, you know, Saturday nights were horrible at that club. So Sunday was even worse. There was maybe seven people in the crowd, average age about 70. And they're in their velvet couches staring at me. And I'm like, oh, my God, George Carlin is in the back of the room watching me bomb. And I came off stage, and he was very complimentary. And he said, stick with the sick shit. Because I had a couple of jokes that were pretty dark. I can't necessarily remember what they were. And I thought, you know, this is your chance to tell him what he means to you.
Yeah.
And so I told him, you were the person that let me know it was okay to question authority, especially the Catholic Church. And I just want to thank you for that. And he was so gracious.
That's amazing.
I felt like I'd met the Pope.
Yeah.
I really did. It was a religious experience for me.
Oh, I don't doubt that.
Yeah.
God damn. What year was that? Do you know?
Probably 1991, maybe.
91-ish. Okay.
Wow. 92, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere between 89 and 93.
God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, that I'm at this point, I guess I'm not necessarily surprised, but every time I hear a story about him, I'm just like, oh, God. It's just like they're all good. They're
never
all...
heard. I've never heard a single story of him treating another comic badly.
Mm-mm. No, and I mean, he was so... This is one thing that I've tried to explore. We've had Kelly Carlin on the podcast too, and we've talked about like just his different sort of phases as a comic. But like, in terms of character, I'd love to know more about how he designed his stage presence and how much of it was natural evolution, how much of it was I want to reflect this, how much of it was I genuinely feel. I mean, most of it felt like it was genuinely from him, but I want to know what part of his gut he was pulling.
I think,
you know,
I think. It started out with him thinking, this is what I have to do to succeed.
Sure.
And then he eventually... Have you heard the story about him asking to be fired? He was in Vegas.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So he's in... but I guess I'll just tell it for the listeners.
Yeah, go ahead. No, yeah, it's been a while.
He's in Vegas, and he was... a lot of people were coming out to see him because he was on the Ed Sullivan Show, and he was still doing his kind of cutesy... didn't really have any a whole lot of edge to it.
Yeah.
You know, any of the edge might have been that, you know, there was a reference to somebody smoking pot or something.
Right.
It was very kind of you had to look for it almost. And he had this epiphany one night on stage where he looked out into the crowd, much like I did when I looked out over the crowd in Vegas. And went, this is not the people I'm trying to reach. These are their parents.
Yeah.
And he thought, and there was a rule that you couldn't swear on stage.
Yeah.
And so they said, and so he swore, and they warned him, and he swore again, and they turned the lights off on him. And he thought it was just very fitting that, and I think he even said, you know, please fire me or something along those lines, but he welcomed it. He was forcing their hand.
Yeah.
And after that, he really kind of had to reinvent himself, but I think he knew immediately So he started dressing differently, mm-hmm. grew his hair out, and the rest is history.
I feel like a lot of people, myself included, I don't do stand-up, but if I were to do stand-up, and let's say I had even a modicum of success, I hate to say this, but I feel like I'm braver as a writer, because if I were stand-up and I was doing well, I'd be too fucking scared to switch anything up. I don't, that kind of epiphany, I think, scares me.
It's especially once you're established.
Right.
Especially once you're established. It is terrifying. I think you have to be willing to not care about money for a period of time.
That's just it, yeah.
Yeah. But the great ones always do it, because I think they're doing comedy for a different reason.
Yeah.
The ones that wind up doing really profound work, I think originally or deep inside them have always had a higher calling.
Yeah.
And it just took them to get to a point where they had to get tired of doing the shitty material and the pandering.
Mm-hmm.
Because comedy's so exciting when you first start doing it. Even if you're pandering, you don't care, because you're making a room full of people laugh. But eventually that begins to wear away, and comes a time in most comics' act where your act is divided into what material you have to do to survive
mm-hmm.
in front of a bunch of drunks at midnight on a Friday,
uh-huh.
and the stuff you're doing for you. And
yeah.
for me, my stand-up was always about probably 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
I just very much related to that feeling he had of not wanting to pander anymore. I mean, obviously he took a route that was a lot that I never really
mm-hmm.
broke from. I still had to do stuff that, you know, was basically shiny objects for drunk
sure,
people.
Sure.
But he had so many, affected me in so many ways. His mm-hmm. his material, his longevity, his championing the underdog, and the fact that he was still funny, maybe a tad bitter, but so funny even into his 70s.
Mm-hmm.
He was, you know, he came out and opened one of his sets. He's probably in his 60s at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Have you ever noticed that most of the women who are against abortion, you wouldn't want to fuck in the first place?"
Right. Right.
What 60-year-old in America
uh-huh.
says that out loud?
Right, right.
And that's why I loved him. He never lost his ability or desire to be edgy.
Mm-hmm.
It was just always there.
There are comics, I feel, though, who could even make something similar like that come across, like you, where you wouldn't be... It wouldn't be obvious that it was a joke. They get booed off the stage, or it'd be obvious that they were a shitty comic. Whereas he could deliver it like, "I'm making several points here."
Yeah,
like, you know what
and
I mean.
And they were
like,
there to see him, and they knew
for sure.
People
absolutely.
Knew what he was getting. I mean, I would love to have heard him do that joke in front of the Blue Hairs in Vegas. That would have
God.
Been fantastic.
Oh my God.
My other favorite line of his, in fact, I think he did it when I sat and watched him that night that he invited me backstage.
Mm-hmm.
He did a list of people he doesn't trust, and my favorite one on the list still makes me laugh to this day is a dentist with blood in his hair.
That's a fucking perfect image.
That's so great.
Oh my God.
That's so great.
And I wonder too, though, if he could imagine necessarily while he's doing this album, because it's directed at people who remember being a kid. Like, it's directed obviously to a younger audience, but like, I don't necessarily think he would imagine that a 10-year-old who's actually in Catholic school is
no.
going to be like, "Oh, thank you for my new fucking guidebook for school." Like, that's so perfect.
Yeah, I don't imagine he thought 10-year-olds would listen to it, but the sense I get from his body of work is that he would have definitely thought that was cool.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because he would have liked to have heard somebody like that. You know, I'm sure the first time he heard Lenny Bruce, it rang his bell.
Oh, my God,
and he thought, this is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm. What would be interesting for me is, obviously, and this is the part where my research fails me, is to know more about his early influences, because he was so straight-laced,
mm-hmm.
so straight-edge.
I think it was a lot of radio guys.
It had to have been,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think...
Because I know he loves Stan Freberg. I know I was a big fan of Freeburg. That's the one that I know off the top of my head. But other than that,
I think he might have also been a fan of was it Fred Allen was a big radio guy. I might be thinking of somebody else that was a fan of him. Oh, maybe it was Johnny Carson that was a big fan of Fred Allen. But yeah, he had a radio career before he did stand up.
So strange. So strange to me.
Yeah.
And now stand ups are going to podcasts, which is fine and great and wonderful and very nice for people. God. To evolve in that way, it's just, I don't know, it still kind of blows my mind. And to stay relevant, again, up till his final album, and I said this on the last time we talked about it, but his final album is fantastic.
Yeah.
And I hadn't listened to a lot of his stuff in the interim years, honestly, between this and that. But God, his last album killed me.
You know, I think one of the things was he stayed grounded and he stayed angry. And I don't think necessarily staying angry is a good thing.
Sure.
For your life outside of comedy.
Right, right.
But for your life in comedy,
mm-hmm.
it's really essential to if not angry, outraged.
Sure. Yeah.
And it was always so organic with him. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some comics where I feel like at least the performance of the anger is a little manufactured.
Sure.
It was never manufactured. If anything, he was holding it back, and the anger came through in the points that he made.
Yeah.
That
makes sense to
me. He just always, right up until the end, had that edge. And that was, as I got older and I was still doing stand-up, that always gave me hope.
Because,
you know, my fear was, oh, my God, I'm going to hit a certain age, and I'm just going to be lame.
Yeah, yeah.
And he kind of let you know that if you stay grounded and you stay outraged, you can stay relevant.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if people either. You made a really great distinction about the anger or again, the outrage on stage, whereas because you can do it so many different ways, not just two different ways, but you can do the way he did it, which is to genuinely have the anger, express it as outrage, and do it creatively. You can treat stand-up as therapy if you want, but then it becomes something else. It becomes Bill Hicks, which is not necessarily to shit on Bill Hicks, but it becomes that, which is its own demon, you know?
I was just thinking about Bill Hicks the other day, who I loved and so wish was around today to give us material on the current political circus. I mean, politics are always a circus, but today the GOP is truly a freak show.
Oh, yeah.
It's... I mean, who would have thought that we would long for the liberalism of Barry Goldwater?
Right.
You know, he would be, he wouldn't even have a chance as a Republican today. They would have.
Yeah.
But Bill Hicks, I don't think his anger was ever manufactured.
No.
I think sometimes maybe he let it get the best of him, but it was still interesting to watch.
Oh, definitely.
You know, when he would melt down and on stage and snap at somebody. I don't know if you've ever seen the video of him. Where he's in Chicago at the Funny Firm.
I think I know where he's just screaming at that woman and calling her a fucking cunt for interrupting his show. Is that the?
I don't know if that was part of the same tape, but
okay.
This is the one where there's a local DJ named Kevin Matthews who would tell his listeners when you're at some public event and somebody's on stage, yell Freebird.
Oh boy!
And so this guy who was a listener of Kevin was like Freebird, and Bill's like what? Freebird. He's like, okay, now what? Freebird. He said, are you just going to say that? What kind of a fucking lemming are you? And then Bill just went on this rant and just picked this guy apart and talked about how Hitler was right. And, of course, people are filing out of the room. And the comics are in the back just thinking we've seen Jesus.
Yeah.
You know? I actually came there. I was working across the street at the Improv that week, so I didn't get to see that. But I heard the other comics talking about it. Oh, man, you missed it. You missed it. But even then, we knew, you know, that Bill was one of the great ones. He wasn't afraid to walk a room. I think to be great, you have to be unafraid to clear a room out.
Right. God, but that's just... It's its own, like, it sounds when you say it that way, it does, obviously it's like this, it's a fucking tightrope walk, But it's also this, like, a tightrope walk can sound like a fuck it gesture, where it more sounds to me like it's severe commitment to what you're doing.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like an artistic commitment. Like, yes. I'm doing my job. I'm going to continue to do my job.
Believing in what you do and knowing 100%. What you're doing is unique and that not everybody will get it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you keep slogging away, your people will eventually come. They may trickle in. You know, yeah. Lenny Bruce said, give me 2,000 fans in every city
mm-hmm.
and I'm fine.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, I don't need to have everybody love me. And I get that.
To whittle them down to yeah. people who are not necessarily who are going to get you right away, but people yeah. who are going to be on board long enough to get your point.
Yeah, because ultimately for longevity, it's not the number of people who like you. It's how passionate people are about you.
Right, 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 right.
Because then they'll hang with you for the long run. And George was smart enough to see that, whereas somebody like David Brenner, who was, you know, fine for his mm-hmm. time, but never really put any real soul into his stand-up, when that flavor of kind of sarcastic observational comedy became so overdone, I don't think he had a real fan base.
Right. I would be afraid, again, personally, to talk about my fears of why another reason I don't do stand-up is to be afraid that people are going to settle into your comedy and maybe stop getting it at some point. It's like, well, it's only the people who are coming to me are the people who got my old stuff. Can I challenge them still? I wonder if that would be scary to people.
I had to go through that when yeah. I first started doing stand-up. Probably the first 10 years of my doing stand-up, I did kind of dark poems mm-hmm. In my stand-up. And there were these radio guys in Indianapolis that weren't yet syndicated. They're still on, mm-hmm. Named Bob and Tom.
Oh, yeah.
And they took an immediate liking to me, and they especially liked the poems, and they played them a lot. And so all of a sudden, I got a following in Indianapolis. And so I would try to have new poems specifically for when I would go to Indy, and they would sure. put me on the air. And then they got syndicated. And all of a sudden, I had this following Fuck. In all these cities. But it was based on my poems.
Yeah.
And I had outgrown the poems.
Shit.
And I couldn't write anymore because there wasn't any. It felt like I had done everything that I wanted to do in that format.
Right.
And so Ooh. Now I had to. You know, I suppose it's how a musician feels when they have a hit that they're so fucking tired of doing, mm-hmm. but they know the audience expects to hear it when they come out there.
Yeah.
So when I was in a city that they didn't know me for the poems, it was such a huge relief.
Sure, sure.
Yet I also made nice money because when I was in a city,
mm-hmm.
I could fill the seats at least for a period of time.
Yeah.
So, but it was kind of this double-edged wow. sword because I think if you really are doing what you're supposed to be doing creatively, you will look back on some of your old stuff and roll your eyes and go, oh, God.
Yeah. I mean, you hope to evolve. One hopes. Yeah. My God, but... So, but you did, when they were expecting the poems, were you at least busting out a few? Like, how much
oh, yeah.
of your act was
yeah.
it? I'm just curious. This is so... I've never heard of
it. Probably... If I did... All the ones that they requested, it was probably 20 minutes.
Okay.
15, 20 minutes. It was probably 7 or 8 poems that were like 2-3 minutes each.
Okay.
Yeah, but I would always just... it was maybe 2 that I enjoyed doing,
mm-hmm.
but the rest of them were, you know, you're reciting.
Yeah.
You're reciting. And there was a lot of other parts of my act, too, that I was tired of. But mm-hmm. if you want to be a headliner, you have to get more laughs than the feature act.
Sure.
You have to keep the laughs going while the checks are going out and people are distracted.
Mm-hmm.
So you need stuff that kind of hammers them.
Yeah.
And or you have to be willing to endure silences, which I was never comfortable enough to do.
Oh, I understand
that.
There
were comics that could do that. I've seen them, you know, comics who were fucking brilliant and had terrible shows.
Right, right.
And I've worked with them, and they almost all wound up succeeding really well because other comics liked them, and when they came out to L.A., they immediately got writing jobs.
Okay.
Because they stuck to their guns.
Yeah.
And the people I know that were just always worried about killing. Mm-hmm. A lot of them aren't even in the business anymore because they were jumping onto a fad of style. Mm-hmm. And when that fad went out, they were forced to look at the fact that there was nothing original about them to begin with.
It feels like it's like there's this easy confusion of a standard, having standards and then having expectations where they seem to be the same thing, but they're not necessarily, where the expectation is that I'm going to kill rather than having a standard of quality to what you do and living with it.
It's exactly it.
Because I remember I went to college in Chicago for 2 years, and
where'd
I had
you go?
A teacher, Columbia College.
Okay.
It was a good school. But I had a teacher, I had this class called image design, and your stuff was going to be judged by, and she made no bones about it, how beautiful what you had shot was. And I could not wrap my mind around it, wanted to quit the class, did my best, I fucking like what I did, but also I didn't try hard enough because your expectation mm-hmm. made zero sense. If you wanted quality, if you wanted my best work, judge it on that. But you just, it's the same thing to me as like killing it. Like you said, like that was, yep. That was the perfect way to put it.
It's
like,
a trap. Killing is a trap. You know,
yeah.
If comics ever asked me for advice, I would say, find your voice, find out what is unique about you and go with that and don't worry about killing. I mean, certainly laughs are important to
sure.
get work, but eventually people will remember you for what it was you did. And that's going to want to make them come back to see you because, you know, it's like Aristotle Onassis said, one of the secrets to success is offering somebody something that nobody else can offer.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's perfect. Again, if there are acts who can slay and they can slay somehow with nothing, with mm-hmm. no content, which is okay. If you can do it and get paid, yeah. I guess great. But I'm one of those people, at least as a writer or an actor, where I'm not really satisfied unless I know what I did was good and that mm-hmm. I gave you something that may sit with you. I hope.
Yeah.
Does that part frustrate you? Because I mean, I know from at least listening to your podcast and stuff, you're a deep thinker. Not everybody necessarily is in the business, and that's fine if you don't want to be. But you feel like maybe you're the kind of guy who would break down your comedy like very, like piece by piece. Where are you? Did you like to dissect your own work, or was it just this works, this doesn't work?
Yes and no.
Okay.
I just always had something in my soul that I was trying to get out, but I felt limited by the just the whole comedy club scene because mm-hmm. you couldn't. I think what I always wanted to do was to get vulnerable and talk about a pain in my soul that I couldn't quite articulate.
Mm-hmm.
So the substitute I had for it was raging at hypocrisy and abusive power.
Mm-hmm.
When really deep down, what I wanted to bitch about was my mom
mm-hmm.
and my dad.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't ever really... It wouldn't have been funny.
Sure.
It wouldn't have been funny.
Sure.
So I think it was the second best thing was for me to be able to do it. And I was good at it because I've been making my peers laugh since I was a little kid, or I should say I was decent at it.
Uh-huh.
I think some of my act was great, and a lot of it was kind of forgettable and so-so.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard sometimes to look at your act objectively.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
At least if you're making your living doing things, because most of us aren't willing to go back to the drawing board.
Sure.
And I think it's impossible, too. I think it just all evolves naturally. Probably the biggest comedic risk I took was in 2004. I started doing a Republican character on stage. I looked not in the same set where I was being myself.
Okay, sure. Okay.
Because I dressed up, you know, as this right-wing Republican. And the way that it came to me was I was on stage with a bunch of other comics like myself, and we were all bitching about the Bush administration and the Iraq War and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, God, I sound like everybody else. What can I do that's different? And then it occurred to me, why don't I become one of these guys that I hate?
Uh-huh.
I thought, I know these guys like the back of my hand. I went to college with them. I've seen them at the golf course. I'm friends with some of them,
uh-huh.
or at least acquaintances. There's a way they walk and talk and dress.
Mm-hmm.
And I instantly knew exactly. I went clothes shopping. I bought a pinky ring in a pawn shop. And I wrote some jokes. And that was probably the closest I've ever come to truly. I feel like that is my most genuine comedic voice. And it's mm-hmm. the only performing I do nowadays is I'll do this character. I don't do straight stand-up anymore. But that was, I think I had to have been sober at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been sober like 2 years at that point. And I think I had to have done that to have the confidence to get on stage and do something so radically different
right.
from anything I'd ever done. Even though the attitude was no different than what I was doing before, the delivery okay. and the premise of it.
Mm-hmm.
The conceit of it was vastly, vastly different.
Sure.
And I was terrified, but it went over. You could hear a pin drop at first.
Mm-hmm.
And this was an open mic where nobody was listening.
Okay.
To the comics, and people are playing darts and they're talking, and I'm like, I'm gonna die a thousand deaths. And I went up, and it just got quiet because at first they were like, "Who's this jackass with the French cuffs and the tie and the pleated khakis and the pinky ring?"
Fuck.
And then once they got the first joke, it was like a bomb went off, and I knew I was on to something. So I think that's probably my most proud comedic endeavor. That's the one thing I've done that I felt was really, really pure. And this was before Stephen Colbert started doing his character. I didn't feel like I was ripping anybody off. I felt like it was truly an original idea, or at least mostly original. I'm sure I was influenced somewhere by some other comic, but that was kind of the arc, a long way of telling you that was my arc of going from people-pleasing to pleasing myself.
Yeah.
And I would have terrible shows sometimes, and I wouldn't care because I knew this shit was funny.
Yeah. And I mean, did it take sobering up to be able to step out of yourself? Because addiction can be very self-involved, even though you're trying to escape.
I think it's the fear. I think once you get sober, you confront so many of your fears that you realize, as one of my friends says, they're a mile wide, a mile high, and paper thin.
Mm-hmm.
And you start walking through some of them, and you realize, what the fuck am I afraid of taking chances for?
Right.
I'm going to take some chances. And so that gave me the confidence to start taking chances. It gave me the confidence to, try doing a podcast that I had no idea it was going to work or not. If you had told me this is going to be your sole gig
right.
a couple of years from now, mm-hmm. I'd have told you were crazy. And I honestly don't miss being on TV at all. I miss the money. I miss the people that I used to work with.
Sure.
But as far as the creative compromise involved in doing television, I don't miss it for a fucking second.
Yeah.
I don't miss being in comedy clubs. I don't miss... You know what I miss? I miss the feeling of having a great crowd and you can completely relax. But there's so much other bullshit that goes with that. The mm-hmm. traveling, the... Are they going to put somebody in front of you who's a terrible setup for you?
Right.
Are some, drunks going to disturb it and kill your rhythm?
Uh-huh.
On and on and on. So I don't miss those things at all. And it's another reason I have such huge respect for George Carlin is the fact that he just kept doing this. His body of work. Is there anybody that has a body of work as large and as impressive as his?
No, I mean, the only comparison I could have made until maybe about a year ago would have been Cosby. And I think we're going to raffle off several defaced albums of his at some point soon. That's gone. Carlin really, especially Bill Cosby was just a storyteller. Carlin had a point and a political, he had a political viewpoint. It wasn't just political, but when I say political, I mean he had this strong viewpoint that was very much fuck you if you disagree, very much a character, but also like we said, there's the difference between,
and there was
the
a heart underneath
100%.
It because of who we went after.
100%. Yeah. And even even if he would occasionally randomly shit on somebody, I hate people who carry around water bottles. It was like, obviously that's cranky old man talking. Yeah. Wait till he starts talking about authority. Give him a second. And I think that's something I didn't understand at the time too, because I went from like being 16 and hearing Class Clown for the first time, that opening up my mind to being like, oh, that's who he is. This, you know, guy in the turtleneck and the long, I don't really like that guy, because I didn't get it. I didn't get the evolution. I didn't see the evolution. It jumped from this to that, and it didn't make sense to me. But once you've had time to listen to or watch most of his, and actually that's the other unique thing about it too, is like most of his specials were HBO specials. You got to watch this guy perform.
Unfiltered.
How lucky are we that the greatest comic was giving us this visually too?
Amazing, because he was very visual.
Mm-hmm. For a number of reasons, I've acted to the point, like, just facial characterizations is one of my favorite. Like, I know I learned a lot about acting just from watching him fucking mug.
Mm-hmm.
In the most fantastic way possible. And it all does, it all roots back to this, I mean, other stuff too, but to the Class Clown thing. I mean, it's a trite comparison to make, oh, were you the Class Clown as a kid, blah, 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 blah. But he breaks it down in such a succinct way here as to why that's important to him.
Did you read his, I can't remember if it was a biography or autobiography.
Which one? I've not read any of the ones that he's written because I suck, but I've listened to his albums. There's Brain Droppings. There's, what's the other one? Good God. But no, I have not. To answer your question.
It was great. I have a terrible memory, but he talks about a lot of stuff. And one of the things that he talked about that I thought was interesting was towards the end of the 70s, somebody made a joke somewhere, or it was a review of something, and it was basically, they were making fun of the fact that he had started to become a caricature of himself with all the hippie stoner stuff.
Okay.
And it crushed him, but being the strong-willed guy he was, he went, okay, I'm going back to the drawing board, and I'm going to have to reinvent myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's when, you know, he hit his, despite his cocaine addiction, which mm-hmm. certainly gave him challenges, he just had that great run in the 80s and 90s
yeah.
where he managed to make that transition from the hippie guy to the even more who he was.
Yeah, yeah. And it's again, it's one of those things where I would love to have seen. It would have been interesting to see him interviewed in person, backstage, at the end of each one of those specials. To mm-hmm. watch his career evolution, and then that said, there are probably plenty of interviews out there, but it would have been interesting to just see who he was after a show. That's something yeah. that did you get to see him perform when you were there?
I got to see part of his show, and okay. then I had to leave early because I had a show
oh, right.
as well.
Ah.
But it was so cool sitting in the audience going, I just talked to him backstage.
Yeah, yeah, holy shit. God, that's amazing.
It was one of the greatest moments I've ever experienced.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so glad I got to meet him.
Ugh.
And tell him, you know, what
yeah,
I thought.
That's
which I'm sure 100 other comics, 500 other comics have done before, but for me, it was great to meet my hero and to be able to say that.
Mm-hmm.
And to have him compliment me, too.
Oh, yeah.
Which was really cool. I mean, some of my stuff, I'm sure he was like, oh, God, cut that out. But the fact that he had something nice to say.
I mean, if you know your shit, you're going to find the stuff that you like and concentrate on that anyway. Just like, yeah. no, don't not do this. Do this. And it's yeah. great that he keep doing the sick
stick
shit.
Stick with the sick shit.
That's fantastic. It's just, that's a perfect, that's the perfect thing. Let's see. Oh, can we briefly talk about your podcast?
Sure.
Because it's huge. It's one of those things where I actually consciously avoided it for a long time, having my own issues and knowing, mm-hmm. you know, it's one of those things like, I don't want this to tell me stuff I already know, but finally having sucked it up. I think I listened to the Paul F. Tompkins episode first. God, mind-blowing. But that show is so incredibly comforting. Do you want to talk about it just a little bit? Because, like, it's such a huge part of what you do.
Well, thank you. And I started it because I had gone off my meds and I was seriously considering suicide, and I didn't realize that that was the depression talking. Mm-hmm. And I had been in therapy and under the care of a psychiatrist and, you know, been going to support groups and sober for a number of years, and I was fooled by it. And I thought, somebody has to get the word out there about the cunning nature of mental illness and how it presents itself as other things.
Yeah.
And I felt like there was a void for how it should be talked about. I felt like there was only two camps, where it was being talked about by academics or experts who were talking down to people, mm-hmm. or it was being talked about by precious new agey people, you know, who were talking about, you know, Mother Earth and, you know, and well, what's the word they use that just drives me fucking crazy? It's like, it's such a Sedona word. oh, God damn it. I'm blanking on it, but sacred.
Oh.
My goal is to do my podcast without ever using the word sacred. And I was right. People were able to relate to the way we talked about our feelings and the way we talked about our issues, that it wasn't precious. And there's a lot of dark jokes thrown in, but it was never... I feel like the podcast never sacrifices vulnerability for a laugh. I feel like any laughter, and we can go a long time without laughs in it, they're in addition to the vulnerability, that the vulnerability and the empathy comes first.
Yeah.
And I realized once I started doing the podcast, this is what I've wanted to talk about on stage forever. Mm-hmm. I just could never find a place that was safe enough, or at least I felt safe enough to be able to talk about these things. They've been inside me since I was a little kid. And so that's kind of where the podcast is. You know, it's a one-on-one interview with a guest, occasionally two guests, but usually just one guest. Mm-hmm. Sometimes a listener, sometimes a fellow comedian, sometimes a doctor. We just talk about all the battles we have in our heads.
Yeah. Those things where I think a lot of us think we can very easily apply the term crazy until we realize there's a lot of specific shit going on in there that used to be diagnosed as crazy, lock you up. But it's like, no, this is manageable.
I think almost all of us have some portion of us where we think if people knew this, they wouldn't love me.
100%. 100%. Yeah. And it's the perfect venue for it, especially if I mean, you could listen to your show casually. I wouldn't recommend it. I feel like it's so dense that it's worth giving it a full listen. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's a good companion for a show where I try and stress listen to the whole fucking album. Like, it's one of those things where you want to do that. And it was making me think, as we're talking about this and talking about comedy, about, you know, on stage killing versus doing your best. It's not a bad metaphor for life. You know what I mean? You know, it's doing your best, which is, you know, listen to his show. Please listen to that show. Mental Thank Illness you. Happy Hour. We did not say the name of the show. I did say it correctly, didn't I? Please tell me
you
I said
did.
It right. Thank
you
God.
Did.
I know people have said it wrong before, but it's worth listening to and keeping in mind that betterment can come. It's a very sacred show. It's what I wanted to tell you. no, but I absolutely love it. And I think it's, you know, people, it's worth listening to. And especially if, listen to it as a companion with this album. Why not listen to it? Because George Carlin was a guy with problems and he fucking still slayed, you know? Mm-hmm. So I have to ask this question just because it's become standard on the show. A million people have answered it in their own ways. So if somebody has not heard, somehow not heard of George Carlin, or let's say they haven't heard old Carlin, or they haven't heard Carlin at all, why, what's important about this album? Why sit down and listen to this?
That's a good question.
Not just why is it important to Paul Gilmartin, but why is it important to everybody? Should it be? Could it be?
You know, I suppose the album is dated in some ways because he was so imitated.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the same reason somebody would say to you, watch Citizen Kane.
Yep.
You may say, you know, that movie was okay, but if you watch it in the context of what ground it broke, then it's worth listening to. But if you don't really understand the ground it was breaking, it might not be interesting for somebody to listen to.
Yeah.
You know, I would say watch a comedian, watch a clip on YouTube of a comic on the Ed Sullivan Show in the mid-60s,
yeah,
and then listen to Class Clown.
Yeah.
And you'll understand what ground it broke.
You can even look up Burns and Carlin, and you'll see the shit he was doing before he was doing this. Yeah. And it's the fact that that stuff is on Sullivan probably 6-7 years before this happens, like that quickly to evolve into this guy. That's a good point. It does need some context. A lot of these albums do. It's one of those things I've talked about it before too. It's like, I'm a big fan of the Marx Brothers. I get why some people aren't, because they just don't get why it's important. But personally, I fucking love it, and I don't understand why anybody wouldn't
like
the Marx Brothers.
I still watch the Three
Stooges. See, that was something we were talking about the other day. Like, it was kind of sometimes there's a versus situation between the two, but I don't think they're necessarily comparable. And I've had to reappreciate the Three Stooges recently. But yeah, no.
I think one of the things that I love about the Three Stooges is how accurately they portray anger.
Oh, yeah.
Their facial expressions. How, you know, when one of them gets poked in the eye, the way their faces scrunch up, that they're consistently surprised that the other one has physically violated them. It's just so. That makes me laugh more than anything.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good point. I'd never actually thought about it that way. That's a fresh way to look at the Three Stooges. Yeah. Is that just for the sake of? Yeah, that's brilliant.
The facial expressions, and I mean Curly, you know, one of the greatest comedic characters ever. But it's also why I love Jim Carrey so much. Like in the movie Dumb and Dumber,
sure,
is how hard he commits to the joke. It is, I mean, he gives his all. He just sells the shit out of those things. He does it to a degree that you just can't physically commit any more than he did without breaking a bone.
Right, 100%. Did you see the sequel? I didn't see it.
I thought it was worth watching.
Really? Okay.
Certainly not as good as the first one.
Sure.
But I just love the first one so much. I'll even take a watered down version of it to get some of it.
I can understand that. Is there? I hate to say that I don't know when this is going to go out because I have so many bangs.
It's okay.
But is there anything that you want to promote just in case, or anything generally you want to promote?
I don't think so. Just the podcast. It's a Mental Illness Happy Hour. The website's mentalpod.com. And yeah, that's
easy
it.
Enough.
Yeah.
Can people follow you? Should people follow you on
Twitter? Oh, yeah. Twitter, it's at MentalPod.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Facebook page for the podcast.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to try and remember to cut this out. The only thing I want to promote is that we have a Parkinson's benefit coming up October 21st, 2015, here in Burbank, provided the Burger King is still functional, which is the first live location used in the Back to the Future movies. Come dress up like Marty McFly. Go to millionmcflymarch.com. You can also donate to Parkinson's right there. You can donate on the day. You could start your own. Just email us. Do whatever you want to do, but go to that. So there we are. Well, thank you for being here.
My pleasure,
this
Jason.
This is a
thank
lot
you.
Of fun.
Thank you for asking me.
Honestly, honest to God, a fresh perspective on this album.
Oh, thank you.
You know, like the last time, it's great because sometimes it's like the last time I spoke with somebody, he gave me his perspective, which was great, but we didn't have a face-to-face and it's really hard for me. So you and I had a lot to
I've
talk
tried
about
interviewing via Skype and it just doesn't work
it's
for me.
It's so hard. It's yeah. so hard. And that's my weakness. Don't get me wrong. That's my weakness and nothing against him. He was a great interview, but it was good to have this, like, you know. So listen to the album, please. Listen to the the Mental Illness Happy Hour. I can't get it out of my mouth. I can't.
It's a mouthful.
I'm frozen by this air conditioner. That's one big
Dude,
problem.
Dude, I'm glad
right
you're
now.
There and I'm here because that's like the Arctic.
I
over
think
where
I gave
sitting.
Billy West an ear infection. I'm fairly sure that happened when he was here for 2.5 hours.
What was his album?
He picked Jonathan Winter's. Oh crap! What's it called? Another another day,
of
another
course
world,
he loves
something like
Jonathan
that.
Winters. Oh, yeah. That makes perfect sense.
Oh yeah, and also. He talked about the first album that he was interested in ever that he ever listened to was a little single, a mini plastic, not vinyl, plastic single of the Three Stooges. We talked about that for a bit, and that's like the origin of like him doing voices. And I actually found a copy for him recently and sent that to him. Doesn't play for shit, but it's cool. It's a nice little memento. But yeah, that was a fun episode. 2.5 hours we talked. It was awesome. Good stuff. Thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit StolenDress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on Facebook.com/ComedyOnVinyl, Twitter @ComedyOnVinyl, and find everything else at ComedyOnVinyl.com.